Welcome to the Apartment Operators Podcast, where you can learn from experienced operators what it really means to be an apartment operator. No fluff, no sugarcoating, just the raw, unfiltered truth of the ups and downs of operating multifamily communities.
Welcome, everybody, to the Apartment Operators Podcast. My name is Joseph Gazan. I'm your host. And today we have Seth. Seth, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on. Excited to be here and talk with you.
Awesome. We start every podcast with letting our guests introduce themselves, tell our audience a little bit about who you are, how you got to where you are, what portfolio you have. Just give us a little bit of a rundown.
Yeah, so I was a 22-year firefighter paramedic, left that a few years back, and got into multifamily investing and development. I got into real estate probably 5 to 7 years ago, and since then we've built out a company that owns just under 2,000 doors, and we've got probably 700 or 800 under construction right now. So we're vertically integrated. So we do a lot of our property management, and I would say not necessarily the ground up development, but if we do like a value add multifamily purchase, and we do a lot of the renovations and interior CapEx items in house.
That's phenomenal. So how does one go from firefighting and paramedic into 2,000 doors, 2,700 under construction?
That's always the question. I was doing that job, had done it for a long time since I was about 18. I loved it. But as I continued to get squeezed by the economy and my paycheck continued to not go far enough, I was trying to figure out a way to buy some time back. And I stumbled into real estate through a college roommate of mine. And then I'd say a year and a half after that, I had worked for a house flipper for a while doing project management. And during that time, I realized that single family and house flipping wasn't really for me. And I had the opportunity that came along between my own money and another investor that I met through a local real estate meetup. We put our money together and I went out and found the biggest thing that we could afford to buy. And it happened to be a 50 unit apartment building. And I basically ran the deal. That was was that he was going to invest with me and then I would run the deal and do all the work. And we did that and executed the full value add plan. After about a year and a half, we pulled out $1.2 million, which between just the two of us, we were able to get all of our original capital out. And then I took my earnings and went and bought another building. And it grew from there. So that's the short story.
No, that's phenomenal. Right now, is your portfolio focused in one location, one city, one metroplex, or how does that look like?
So I would say primarily our heaviest presence is in Central Ohio, which is where I live. I'm in the Columbus, Ohio market. I would say most of our stuff is here. We're co-GP on some stuff in Oklahoma, Illinois. And then there's three of us that make up our company now as far as like executives go. And we've got one of them has got a pretty big portfolio in Salt Lake City, Utah, where he lives. But otherwise, I'd say 80% of our stuff is here in Central Ohio.
Okay. With that big concentration in one spot, do you self-manage? Do you do a third party? Which way did you guys go?
So we do a little bit of both. I've got three properties that we have third-party management on, mainly because one of them is that way because of the area and the tenant class. Like, we just felt more comfortable with somebody that kind of was specialized in that area. And so we didn't want to manage that one. But we did do $1 million of construction on that portfolio. We couldn't do both when we took it over. We couldn't manage well and manage the construction. We knew there was a bunch of CapEx. So we focused on doing that and allowed this other company to come in and do the tenant management. And then I've got another about 86 or 90 doors that's managed by a third party person. And it only because it's a little bit farther east from Columbus. And it's my own personal stuff. And so it's out of the way for us to go out there. We don't really have any, but they already had a team in place out there. I knew one of the owners. So it just made sense. But everything else that we have, we self-manage. We have a team of about 27 people that work for us, and they do renovations and the management side of things.
So how do they compare, your third-party management properties and your in-house property management?
Yeah, good question.
Bit of a leading question there.
But yeah, no, I think it's good. So as far as like time freedom goes, third parties obviously frees you up to do a whole lot. And when we decided to vertically integrate, it sounded like a great idea at the time, but then I became an employer, and I never really thought of that side of things when I get into investing. So there's a lot of things that we deal with that are employment based. So that's a little bit different. But as far as like management wise, I still think that we probably perform better only because nobody really manages it like they do if you own it. And we're able to surgically weave our way through the business plan versus the one of the portfolios we have, it's 70 units that's managed third party. I feel like they're more of a, I don't know, they're doing a lot of surgical work with a spoon, if you will. It's not, they get it,
that one. Yeah.
No, we took it. We took the occupancy on that one down to maybe 10%. We had to completely rebrand the place, go in and do all kinds of renovations, floor to ceiling. We did roofs, all kinds of exterior stuff. And they really struggled with getting it leased back up. And so it wasn't until we came in and said, hey, let's do this. We gave them the plan. They executed the plan we gave them, and then it worked. So I think even then they seem to be more costly. We're always looking at being cost effective because we're looking at managing it, but we're also looking at the returns. We're looking at the full picture. And they're only seeing it from, they're like all third-party management companies that are not owners, where they're looking at, they're a for-profit business. So for them, they don't really necessarily care about your underwriting. They don't care about your projections. They don't care about your cash flow. They do what they got to do to run the property. But if that means running the, or leasing it out lower than market to keep it full, that's what they're going to do, unless you're really watching over them.
It's one of the biggest challenges in the industry when it comes to third-party property management is the model we use to compensate them. And you look at it and you say, okay, I can get $100 more per month for that unit if I push it hard. So they look at the amount of effort they have to do to get that extra $100, and that will take the property to occupancy down. So for them, at the 3, 4, 5% you pay them out of the gross, it's a wash. So why do the extra hard work?
Yeah. We've had that issue with staff that we've had to let go, where they don't understand the multiplier. If we increase the NOI by X, it can skyrocket the value of the property. Like, we've tried to teach that to the folks in our offices, and some of them get it and some of them don't. But to that end, like you just said, that the path of least resistance for them is to keep the rents a little bit lower, maybe just below the fringe of market, keep the place full. And so again, if I'm buying it and I own it myself, that might be great, right? If my basis getting into the property, I bought it 20 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever, maybe I keep it low, yeah. I keep it full, the cash flow comes in, I'm okay, I'm a happy camper. But when you buy it with a specific business plan in place to value add or exit in 3 to 5 years, or you bought it on bridge debt, and hey, in 18 months or 2 years, we got to refi and you have to hit specific metrics, you don't have the luxury of running the property that way. And there's a big disconnect between third-party management companies and people that are buying value-add multifamily. And the only time I see people really be successful is if they buy a big enough property where they can bring in institutional management, or really involve the management company at the contract signing timeframe. I would say if you're buying a 50 unit or a 30 unit or a 60 unit, the management company that's going to run that for you is different than the company that's going to run a 200 unit or 180 unit. Or if you have a portfolio of 300 doors, it's just different levels of management, and it's different levels of, I want to call them more savvy, but it's the same thing as if you're a mom and pop owner with 20 doors versus a guy that has 200 doors. Like, you just evaluate everything differently.
Yeah, but our experience and the podcast guests that we talked to all pretty much got to the same conclusion of setting up their own management company. And for the end reason of, it doesn't matter what's up the food chain in the property management company, at the end of the day, you have $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year person running the property.
True.
That's just the end of it. So it all comes down to who's that person and who's the supervisor that runs that person. And if they're good, if they're not good, they're not good. The only thing that goes in favor of the bigger companies is they usually have better hiring skills and better system in place for those two individuals to do their job, which kind of gives them a little bit of a better success rate. It's not guaranteed,
unfortunately. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, I think that they bring the infrastructure that you lack if you're trying to start your own management company. That's something that was really tough for us. Was, we're operators, we're owners, we're investors, we weren't employers. And bridging that gap was tough. We ended up hiring a really solid asset manager who had started and scaled two property management companies. And so he, when we found him, he was the CEO of a larger company and he was doing all the ops. So we brought him in basically to buffer me from the management company to where I didn't have to make those decisions, because I was getting flooded with people, the on-site person calling us all the time, asking for direction. That is not the highest and best use of my time. And so once we brought Mark in, it really, really helped us systematize things and stabilize the management company and grow that and be strong. So that was, yeah, you're right. And I will say too, with regional or with larger companies, I've seen them where maybe they don't even have, like, they have the local people, like you said, but then they just have one regional person. If that regional person quits, now they have to bring somebody new in. Like, there's now that person has to come in and learn the properties and learn all the different things. And that's where you said it comes down to having that $60,000 a year person on the property. And if they're good, if they're not, then the property will suffer.
Yeah. So let's talk about that point in time when you guys made the decision to start your own management. What were the, how was the conversation at that point? What were the reasons you even considered it? Pros and cons that I'm sure there was a conversation and eventually somebody agreed to bite the bullet. But because again, from experience, personal experience, and from talking to a lot of guests, property management, in-house property management is less of a profit center and more of a control thing. Right? Yeah. It allows you to do things, like you said earlier, be surgical about executing versus trying to work through somebody that is doing surgery with a spoon. I love that. I'm going to totally going to steal that phrase from you. So what were the leading drivers in that decision? How big was your portfolio when you made that decision? What kind of scale you felt was required or justifiable in order to make that transition?
Yeah, so I think that we were, God, what were we at? We were probably at 250 doors here locally at the time. And then we were buying a 180 unit complex. And traditionally we would buy something, keep the staff around for a little while, let them go. If there was staff, some of the stuff that we bought, like the first 50 unit didn't have any staff. The next one I bought after that was a 40 unit. It didn't have any staff. It was a little bit different, but when we bought this 180 unit, it had staff on site. The property was a B-class property. It was being ran well. The rents were low. That was really the value add play, was just taking rents to market. So just having better oversight and management. But we really felt that the person that was on site there working was salvageable, that she was willing to learn. She was excited about the new takeover. We had maintenance guys on site that were great. They still work for us to this day. The gal that we originally had hired, she just left at the beginning of the year. And I think that gave us the idea where, like, look, we have a kind of on the ground team in place. Maybe it makes sense for us to just start doing this on our own. And we'll just start with this one property and see how it goes, rather than bring in somebody else and make these people employees of that company. We'll just make them employees of our own company and we'll go from there. And that was about the thinking that went into it. And what we didn't realize at the time was the gal that we were going to absorb and employ, she was a spoke in the wheel to a larger nucleus company down in Columbus, which I knew the company, but we thought that she was more like all-inclusive, handling everything on the site. And it wasn't until after we had closed and took over that we realized that she was just a satellite person sending out, well, the meat and potatoes of the company was down in Columbus, and they were handling all the accounting, all the bookkeeping, all the bill paying, like they were handling all of that. And all of a sudden that was on her shoulders. And it just became clear after a few months that, like, we were really, there's a lot more to this than we had anticipated. And so we had to halt what we were doing and really get aggressive on trying to figure out the right solution. Who's the accounting company that we had, for instance, the accounting company we were using, they were no longer able to handle just the volume of transactions we were doing. So we had to figure out find a new company, and then just all the tax stuff and just the things you don't think about, right? You get an owner statement and you're like, oh, this is all spelled out for me from third party, but how do you prioritize things? Or is this maintenance and repairs, or is this CapEx? Is this all the different things that normally a third party management company has an accounting person on staff and then they do that for you. Now all of a sudden we were having to do it, and the person that we thought could do it couldn't do it. And yeah. So it was, like I said, we instantly were on our heels trying to figure this out.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. Now, also a lot of people don't realize that you have your field team and you have your back office team in property management, right? Your field team is the on-site manager, the leasing, the maintenance guys, and they operate the day-to-day. They don't have the bandwidth or capacity to handle bank reconciliations and picking and choosing which invoice gets paid when and what general ledger account every expense goes into. And that's really where, when we talk to clients sometimes and tell them this is the property management fee and this is payroll, and they go, what do you mean? Isn't payroll included? No, the payroll is for the field team, and the property management fee usually is to supervise the field team to run the back office team. That's just a normal misconception. And yeah, can totally understand why your on-site manager couldn't handle of that. Yeah. So how long ago was that, the setup?
So we took that property over maybe 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, somewhere in there.
Okay, so Smash Cat to today, right? You've been doing property management for 3 years. You mentioned you have a team of 27. How's your organization look like today?
You may have I would say, out of the 27 people, I'd say probably at least half of those people are construction and maintenance guys. And then we have specifically about the 450 units that we manage. We have one office person. She came from an institutional management company, so she's really a solid A player. She's been instrumental. We have one leasing agent. We've got another one that we're in the process of hiring, because again, that's all part of it too, right? Is replacing people and training people and all the things that we didn't think about. And then the rest of it's made up of maintenance and construction workers. And then we have two guys that work for us remotely they audit all of our books. So they work with, we brought in an accounting/bookkeeping company that does all the bookkeeping for the properties as well as the management company. And then the two guys that we use for auditing, they assist with that, but their main role is auditing all the transactions, all the bookkeeping, making sure that everything's on the up and up. Because a lot of the stuff that we do are 506 B or C syndications. And so our bookkeeping and record keeping is held to a pretty high standard. So we have to make sure that we can't afford to have somebody stealing from us and us not catch it, or a property get misbilled or something like that happens. And I've seen that with people that try to manage themselves, it starts to get convoluted. And I had a guy tell me once when I was getting started, I went to him, to his group, and brought him a deal. And I wanted him to OGP with me. And he was like, we won't do it unless we take 70% of the deal. And the reason being is because most of the people that do this, where they've always seen people fall apart or these deals go south, is the financials and the bookkeeping and the record keeping. And it's one thing to be on social media talking about buying apartments and syndicating. It's a whole nother thing to actually be successful at it and execute what you told people you were going to do. And that was why he felt that way. And I can see why now, just as extensive as it has to be. Even if you're using third party, what they're giving you may not be capitalized correctly, or may not be, most property management companies don't understand all that. They're just booking invoices maybe it was supposed to be capitalized, but it was put in repairs and maintenance or whatever. And all of that affects your depreciation, and it all affects your taxes. It all affects a lot of that stuff. And so you have to make sure that's right.
Yeah. And the person that does the data entry at the property management team is also not a highly paid CPA. It's a bookkeeper at best, just a glorified secretary normally. And then, we found things miscategorized. We found income items in the expense. We found expense items in the income. We found other properties, stuff in our property. Mm-hmm. Auditing is absolutely a very critical piece of running the bookkeeping, especially if somebody else makes the lower level decision of what goes where.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you guys do a lot of value add, right? So one of the things we love to ask about is, what value add items do you guys love to do? And we try to focus on interesting stuff, right? Everybody can raise rent. Everybody knows how to apply rubs. Give us a few more income generating activities that you guys do, and then we'll flip the question into the expense in a second. So let's start with the income side of things, right? Ways to increase income that are not raise rent and apply rubs.
I think for us, though, I took over a property and it just seemed to be a lot of pets on the property. And that was never something that, again, it's not rocket science. When we looked at the expenses or the income, they all the leases that we were looking at said no pets, but nobody was actually charging pet rent or pet fees or whatnot. So that's something that we really cracked down on. And we were able to create a bunch of value just by that. We have another one that we went into it when we were going through due diligence, looking and figuring out, like, how can we put in-unit laundry in an existing building already and it meet code and whatnot. And it was expensive to do, but that was how we were able to get $300-$400 more a month in rent than what was on the pro forma, or we could have kept it like a traditional C-class with a common laundry room, or maybe you had laundry on that floor or whatever, something that you find common in a lot of the 70s and 80s builds. We were able to retrofit it and go back and put laundry in the units. So that was something that was an expense, but again, the amount that we saw a rent increase was substantial that we were able to capture because of that, because we were marketing to a different type of tenant. I think that's been good. We've done like covered parking. We've done common areas that we converted into storage units and then rented those out. We've done, trying to think of what else that you would maybe haven't seen before. I don't know. I think a lot of it's pretty common sense on ways to add value to existing stuff. But we've also had some stuff where we thought, oh, we could do this. And then when we start really digging into it, and we're like, no, there's just no way feasibly to do it and it works.
Give us examples of those. That's interesting.
So again, we've tried to do doing the in-unit laundry. It's worked in some unit, in some buildings, and it hasn't in some other ones. And then we had one parking, we have one building that we looked at doing covered parking because that was going to be up here in like central Ohio. We get snow, we get winter, and we thought that would be able to, we'd be able to do that. But then zoning came back and they were like, we started the project and they stopped by and were like, hey, the inspector was like, what are you guys working on? And we were trying to tell him, and he's like, no, you can't do that. Or they wouldn't allow it. They didn't like the way it looked. And so that was something that we learned, a lesson we learned there.
An expensive one.
Yeah. Just luckily we didn't get too far into it, but that's also why now, like, we always trying to sneak around permitting and getting playing. Like, we try to swim in the same direction as the municipalities, because you might get away with it once or twice, but there's going to come a time where you get dinged. And if you would have just reached out to him and gotten approval, or you would have just reached out to him and done it, you would have probably been able to do it. But because you went out on your own and tried to circumvent them, it can be costly. So
yeah, you don't want to piss the code guys off, because they can be very vindictive and petty.
Yes, they can be. Yeah, they can manipulate that code to serve you or to hinder you, for sure.
Yep. Okay, so let's flip the coin. Let's talk about the other side of the equation, ways to decrease expenses.
For us, it's like when we go in, we're usually doing head-to-toe renovation. So we go in and we always, like when we do due diligence, we're always like, what is going to become a maintenance issue? So even if it's not broke right now, we fix it. So like we're replacing toilets, we're adding shutoffs, or we're replacing the water lines like from that goes into the toilet. We always take a look at that. We always replace the shutoff. Some of these older apartments don't have any shutoff, so you have to add those in there. But we either add it or we replace it and replace the line. We always, like in the vanities, if we're going to replace the vanity, we always replace the drain lines. Bathtubs, we're always looking, are they surrounds or are they tile, or what is the situation? But we always try to get in there and swap out the diverters. Because those are when a tub is leaking or dripping all the time, that's where your money's going down the drain. If you're paying for water and sewer, traditionally water in that sense, because you're not going to be using sewer, but we always in due diligence figure out, okay, do we have to go through the wall, like through the front of it, to where we're going to have to tear up the surround, or can we get through a closet or get through another unit? Like, how do we get to that? We always, same thing in the kitchens, drain lines, shutoffs. If we're buying something that has through the wall ACs, we always plan on replacing those. Just, it's part of the renovation, because you can't go through and make an apartment look really nice and keep this old smoke stained, stinky air conditioner. And then sometimes what we'll do is we always check to see, are they running on 120 or 110 or 220? And if they're 220, we will sometimes on these older ones, they'll have like floor-based heating, but then they'll have through the wall air conditioners. Mm-hmm. We'll swap it out with a newer kind of eco-friendly air conditioner that does both heating and cooling. And so those require there to be a 220 outlet there. So sometimes maybe they've ran off a 110 in the past, and we'll have an electrician come in and say, can we convert this to 220? And if we can, then we do that, because running those floor-based heaters are very expensive. Yeah. And so for us, is if we can make the tenants, no matter what market you're in, I always feel like tenants are paying electric. Mm-hmm. Not all markets that we're in, can we bill back water and sewer? Because if we did, we're like the only one doing it.
Yeah.
And so we sometimes will just build it into the rent. But in those situations, if we can make the electric bill cheaper for the tenant, then we know that we can raise our rents. So yeah, it's going to offset that way. But yeah, we try to make everything new, light fixtures, low flow stuff, and all that. But when we go through, that's why if you were to buy something from us and you look at what's your repairs and maintenance budget, our budget after we've gone through and renovated everything is almost nothing, because we eliminate all the things that are going to cause us maintenance issues. And then for the next, whatever our hold period is, we have very little maintenance calls because everything's new.
Yeah. You invest the CapEx up front instead of dealing with the OpEx and the labor costs that come with that later on, because your maintenance guys will be working nonstop on work orders. Your retention is not going to be the greatest because your tenants are not happy. And so sometimes it's worth it to invest the CapEx up front. I mentioned retention. How is your retention looking like? Are you guys doing anything specific to increase retention, like resident events or resident retention programs? There's all kind of ways people use that, try to do things to increase retention.
Yeah. So none of this, I wouldn't say any of the properties that we had to do any kind of retention program. Most of the stuff that we're doing is we're just creating such a better product than what else is out there in that class of asset that people don't want to leave. We bought one last year that the rents, the majority, it was 113 units. The majority of the rents were $300 to $400 below market. And we've gone through and cleaned the place up and done a ton of exterior work. And then we're going through and doing common space and renovating some, but we're just taking people to market and they're staying. I think it's because our customer service is strong. Our response to maintenance issues is strong. They know if it's broke, we're going to fix it. They don't have to be afraid to call. We respond to work orders quickly. Like, I think that we provide pretty good customer service in a sea of not great customer service in like C-class and I'd say like B-minus assets. We have not really had to do it. We've done some things like dog parks and storage and like a covered parking, things like that we are trying to draw people in. And I think that maybe that kind of helps as well. But for the most part, I don't feel like we've had to do anything that's really had to retain people. We've done some different things to bring people in upon stabilization. So if we bought a property and we took it from 90% occupied to 10, because we had to go in and rebrand and do tons of CapEx and whatever. Like when you get done with all that, you have an empty building. How do you draw people in at that point? Then yes, we've done concessions and lowered security deposits and done first month's rent free and done concessions like that to get people to come in. But once they're in, then after a certain time that goes away.
Yeah, that first month free, the 99 moving specials and stuff like that, those from our experience, I've always came back to bite us in the behind. So we don't do those anymore. You can operate in a hybrid mode where you self-manage some of it, your third party, some of it. How does a typical asset management look like? Who talks to the third party versus who talks to the on-site? Is there a cross between them? Is it the same person split between asset management and property management? How does that look like in your organization?
Yeah, great question. So there's like the three of us, I call it owners or executives. And then we have an asset manager. He's got 25 years of development and kind of asset management experience. And so he oversees all the staff, all the properties directly. He basically has a dashboard of all the properties and what they're doing. And then we meet twice a week with him and say, okay, here's where we're at. Here's where we want to be. And then he guides the crew and the team to get there. We set up specific KPIs and different metrics to make sure that we're moving in the right direction. But he's definitely it used to be myself and my partner here in Ohio. Like we were 12-hour days, just grinding away, trying to make sure that all this was going to work. And then we were like, man, we got to get, there's somebody out there that can do it better than us in a less amount of time. And so we found this guy, we hired him. And he's been phenomenal for us to continue to grow, but get some of those things off of our plates. Traditionally, yeah, he interacts with our staff, does the leadership meetings, like he handles everybody. And then he also interacts with a lot of the third party folks. Some of the third party that's here in Central Ohio, they'll still call me to go over some things, but I try to push them off to talk to our asset manager. Like it's like you have to train them, or maybe they can't get a hold of our asset manager, or maybe they don't get the answer from him that they want. So they always try to play mom against dad. And so I just, that happened. We start seeing that happen. We just push them back to the other guy and make sure that we don't want that. That's kind of how it works. We're set up no different than if we were working completely third party and we just had an asset manager and he dealt with the management companies. That's kind of how we set it up.
Gotcha. So he's working with the on-site and with the third party.
He's not like in the office leasing apartments. Like he's not the on-site person. Yeah. He's not the on-site person. But yeah, he's like the head of everything on the ground.
Gotcha. That allows you guys to focus on other things. That makes total sense. But yeah, when they start with mom said, dad says, go ask your mother.
Yep, go back over there. Yeah, exactly.
If you went back in time and met young and the premise is that you can tell yourself that 2009 was the bottom, buy everything you can, what advice you give your younger self?
That's a good question too. I think that back then I wouldn't have known what an asset and a liability was. So I think it would be the first conversation I'd have to have with myself, but is making sure that you're getting in the right deals. I think that there's a lot of people that they're just, at least up until recently, the rates have gone up. So people have slowed buying, but people were just buying deals. I see it on social media all the time. Oh, I got this under contract, that under contract, and all this different stuff. And it all sounds great, but actually executing on the deals is, you never hear that. So that would be something that I would say is like making sure you're getting in the right deals, not just any deal, and making sure that if you're putting stuff under contract, that it's the right deal. Like I'd rather do two deals a year or one a year than do 10 of the wrong ones. So that's what we've always looked at, is I feel like people just have a race. It's a race to scale. It's a race to get to 1,000 doors. It's a race to grow this big thing. In doing that, I know a lot of people who've gotten burned because they bought something that they shouldn't have. I actually just spoke to a guy the other day that did 10 years in prison because he exploded his growth in that like 2003 to 2008 timeframe. And then in 2009, when things were crashing down and coming apart, some of the properties that he had were in central Ohio, but they were in areas that were drastically affected by the auto industry. And when it was collapsing and laying people off, and he couldn't pay for the property, stopped paying for themselves. People weren't paying their bills. They were moving out. And he started commingling funds between those properties and other ones, trying to like keep those ones afloat. And even though he had gotten advice from his legal team and from his accounting group, who said that, yeah, you can do that, you can't do that. And so he ended up doing 10 years in federal prison because of it. And I just met him a few weeks ago. So I think that is something that I would communicate to myself back then, even, is that, yes, you want to scale, but scaling too quickly can kill you. And I think that's something that a lot of people miss. Everybody wants to get real big, but when you get that way and you don't have the infrastructure, it can really be costly.
Yeah. I call it the sprint to the closing table. While there's a whole marathon waiting for you right after that signature, right?
That's right.
So that's a very good insight. And I absolutely agree with you. I've seen people overscale too fast and they're paying the price. I think in 2023, where we are right now, the market is different and it's going to be dramatically different in the next few years. And only the top operators are going to come out of it. Let's just say that. With that said, like before we're wrapping up, what is your outlook for 2023, 2024? Where do you see the economy? What are your plans? Are you still buying? Are you holding off? Give us your 2 cents.
Yeah, so we're in a unique situation because of where we're at in Central Ohio. Intel is building they're investing $20 billion in our local market, and that's phase one of five. So they're saying that they could go up to $100 billion. I don't know if you followed Congress and what's happened to that, and I follow it because I'm in the area, right? It's 10 minutes from my house. But they passed the CHIPS Act at the end of last year. So basically, this whole deal is backed by the federal government. It's happening, and what's happening here in Central Ohio is just crazy right now. And in the county that I live in alone, we have to be building 6,000 apartments or homes annually just to keep up with the growth that's projected to be coming. And it's not projected to pull it out of the air. They're looking at Chandler, Arizona, where their other factories at, and saying, look, in the last 20 years or whenever that was, I can't remember the year that they built it, but as that there, they've picked that spot and they invested there, and what it did to that local area, just gearing off of those numbers, which this investment here near us is bigger than that. It's like we can't build enough. There's not enough product here on the market. So us, we're digging in and going deeper in our own market, because if you can buy it now or build it now, what it's going to be worth in 10 years is you're probably looking at Phoenix, Arizona, or Salt Lake City, Utah, or somewhere out in California where, you know, the paying $65,000 a door, which is crazy to some of the people that I am around in Central Ohio, or like Columbus, for instance. Columbus, you're buying stuff at $100,000 to $110,000 a door. That's 30 minutes from where we're doing a big development. We're betting on our local market. We're betting on our local economy. I think it's different than anywhere else in the country. And I wouldn't want to probably be developing anywhere else, but we know what's coming to our area. And so a land grab right now, where a lot of developers are buying anything that they can get their hands on that makes sense. Obviously, we should be breaking ground on our big development here, I would say in the fall of this year. It's 200 apartments, 170 condos, and 250 single family homes. So the single family homes we will not build. We'll sell that off. It makes sense for us right now to be doing that. So that's what we're working on. And as far as the rates go, if you're doing institutional, right now, we're seeing stuff in the low to mid fives. I mean, if you're doing, depending on, I just did 2 refis. I was under 6% on those, and it was through like regional banks. So it just depends on where you're at and what you're looking at. I think the tenant class is important. The location's important. I think that the stuff that was more tertiary markets and rural areas are getting squeezed right now a little bit. You're better to probably sit tight and just hang on. And if the cash flow is great. And I think that's something that we'll see too, is as their debt service expires, if they were interest only, or they were in bridge debt. We've got bridge debt that was it was 6%. When loans were going out at 3 to 3.5%, bridge debt was 6, 6.5%. Like,
yep.
That was crazy. Right now, bridge is like 9.5 to 10. So
yeah, double digits.
Yeah. So I think if that loan is coming to a close and the deal only worked because you thought you were going to get in at 4.5% still at the end of that, and now you're having to get in at 6, or 6.5, or even 5.5, like I said, if you get institutional, that could make your deal not so amazing anymore.
Yeah, and that's going to cause a lot of pain in the near future.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like I said, we'll, I don't know. I mean, there seems to be like some waves happening already. I know there's some pretty big players that are, have, sounds like they've defaulted on some loans. And then I know there's some other pretty big equity groups that have caused, have put a freeze on anybody withdrawing their money. And so some of the bigger players are
bracing.
Yeah, they're like the first indicator that something could be coming. But do I just, I don't think that we're going to see stuff that, like you're, like you said, you're picking up stuff in 09 for pennies on the dollar. I don't see that happening. I don't see that. It's a completely different type of economy right now than it was back then. And why we're, where we're at is different than back then. So I don't know that we're going to necessarily see that. But the longer this goes, you're going to have to, sellers are going to have to adjust their price, and buyers are going to have to, they're going to have to come off the 2009 numbers. I've seen a lot of that too. Where,
yeah, I know. I agree. I don't think we're going to see the same level of shitstorm we had back in 08. It was like a perfect shitstorm. A lot of things were happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. We're not overbuilt like we were. There are some pockets in the market out there that are overbuilt, but overall, as a country, as multiple states, we're not overbuilt as we were in 2008. So I think we have some room there. I do think there's going to be some blood in the water. I think there's a lot of people that were playing the musical chair game in the last few years, buying, selling, buying, selling, buying, selling, with the hope that when the music stops, they don't have it. Now the music stopped, and let's see who's got the chair, right?
Yeah.
And can they hold to that chair, or are they going to fall off? Hopefully not a lot of groups out there will fall off. I don't wish that to anybody. I want to be respectful of your time. This has been a great conversation. If any of our listeners wants to reach out, maybe invest with you guys or hire you guys to help them with their project, how can they find you?
Yeah, so and you can find me on all social media platforms. You just look up my name, Seth Teagle, and it should pull it up. If you're looking to invest or learn more about that, you can go to our website. It's www.thestreamgroups.com. And then we do, I would say, when I was in the fire service, I taught at the Ohio Fire Academy, and I taught at one of the colleges. I taught paramedicine at one of the colleges. So I've always enjoyed teaching and giving back. The Firehouse Bros is our brand for education. And I don't want to call it coaching, but I've learned a ton over the years. And when I got started, I wish I would have had somebody that could help me, be training wheels for me. And that's what we do through that is we offer that to people that are getting started or are looking to get started in commercial multifamily or commercial real estate in general. I'm linking up with us through that website, which is thefirehousebros.com. And that's our education platform.
Awesome. And we'll definitely make sure to put all those links in the show. Thanks a lot, Seth. This has been a great show with a really good conversation. I appreciate your journey.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome. And for you, the audience, if you would like to listen to more episodes, we're on YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, anywhere you can consume a podcast. We're there. Would appreciate if you can leave us a review, 1 star, 5 star, whatever you feel we deserve. Please go ahead and subscribe and leave us a review. We appreciate that. And until next time, thank you for joining.
Thank you for listening to our show. If you want to enjoy more episodes, please subscribe on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. For questions or feedback, please visit our site at www.aptopr.com.